Game on 2FM.
With Gillette. Great performances begin with a comfortable close shave from Gillette. Gillette, making men's lives just that little bit easier.
Game on 2FM.
With Gillette. New SkinGuard Sensitive Razor. The first razor of its kind designed to stop irritation on sensitive skin. Gillette, the best a man can get.
If you've been there before, if you've felt that real pressure before, then you're less likely to be as intimidated by it. It's going to be intimidating, there's no doubt about that at all, but we believe this group are probably the best equipped to cope with that.
It did seem a million miles away there the last couple of years, but I feel I'm back to full fitness at the minute, so I'll always be available for my country, and who knows what will happen in the future.
TJ is a good mate of mine, I'm happy for him playing such good rugby. I suppose he's, I see it from a different perspective, not from as much as a supporter's perspective. We have different chats. He's been in Ireland now a long time, and he's really that stalwart at eight, as we've seen how many minutes he's actually played in the World Cup so far. So I think he's quite irreplaceable there for me.
Game on 2FM.
Hello and welcome to Game On with Marie and Donica. You've just heard some of what's on tonight's show. We've BJ Botha and Tomás O'Leary, who are looking ahead at the World Cup quarterfinals. Paul McShane is on about his new club Rochdale and his ambition to get back in the Irish team. And Shep is chatting US sport. You can get in touch by text on 51552 or Twitter at GameOn2FM. Marie, what's catching your eye in the world of sport at the moment?
Well, we love all the overachievers here in Game On, and we have another one. Pacey Japan winger Fukuoka. It's not a case of
What's
catch
his name?
Him. Fukuoka. We're very good at pronouncing names here on Game On as well.
That one's a fiery one, isn't it?
You have to be careful with that
you
one.
You do, yeah.
So it is not a case of catch him if you can, but catch him while you can, because Sunday's quarterfinal against South Africa may be the last game he plays for the Brave Blossoms, because at 27, he is going to go to medical school. So after being a hero at the World Cup, he's going to head off and become a doctor.
Look, we've had a few rugby players do it before. Jamie Roberts, Felipe Contepone. They've all studied while they're playing. I think it's a shame to lose him. He's been actually the player of the tournament, the guy that everyone's looked forward to seeing. I know he's going to play sevens in the Olympics, so he'll move to sevens, and it's amazing that his preparation is a Rugby World Cup in 15 to get ready, as opposed to Greg O'Shea, who's hanging around with Deiran in the morning.
Well, that's the standard now, Sevens, medicine, Rugby World Cups, do it all.
There you go. They do it all, those rugby lads.
So another one that I was interested in today as well was that East Kerry player Michael Foley had a big decision to make last week. He could have lined out for his club in a Kerry Senior Football Championship quarterfinal or appear on winning streak. I'm not going to tell you which he went for.
He went for...
Which would you have went for?
Winning streak every day of the week. Honestly, the club is great, but winning streak is the mecca, the big one. Artie Whelan for the afternoon.
Well, he didn't.
Oh.
Yeah, the GAA loyalty shone through, and he is going to play the match, and his sister is going to represent him on winning streak.
No way. What percentage? Or do they fight that out?
Yeah, we'll have to find that out.
That's an ambition of mine, to be in the audience on winning streak and not just thrown in there for the crack, but to actually have someone and have one of the banners, best of luck, Nana. Or
so your ambition is not to be on winning streak, just to be in the audience.
Well, but to be tied to someone so that you actually have to make a banner properly, and winning streak is priceless.
What
love
about
it.
The money? Would you not be wanting to go on for the money?
Yeah, of course you take the money, but it's better if the person gets the money and then they get all the letters, kind of go and gives a few quid, and then you can tap them yourself for that cup of tea every now and again.
So if anyone has plans to go on winning streak and they're looking for somebody to go in the audience and make a banner, text 51552 and Donegan might join you.
My other ambition is to be, and I told you this earlier, is to be in, the photos with the greyhounds, when a greyhound wins a race, they put him on a podium and put a lovely little jacket on him, and all these people that no one really knows stand in behind him. That's where I want to get. I just want to be in one photo beside a greyhound with a cup.
I think that's more kind of down or up Ruby's alley. Would you go into the winning horse picture?
No, that's not the same. It's the whole podium and the jacket on the dog. It's just ridiculous. I love it.
Okay, well, enough about you and winning streak. It's time to get on to rugby. And of course, Joe Smith named his team today, and we have Tomás O'Leary on the line. Tomás, strong team. I suppose it was kind of as expected. What were your thoughts?
prizes from Joe Schmidt. He's reverted to, I suppose, tried and trusted, particularly, you know, the likes of Rob Kearney, who's performed so magnificently in recent games against New Zealand, and back, you know, in the back row with Peter O'Mahony. I suppose he was fantastic in the victory, you know, 18 months ago. So, no major surprises. Obviously, his hand was forced with the suspension of Aki in the centres, so I don't think he had too many decisions to make.
Just to give people an insight into Joe's team, he's gone with Keane Healy, Rory Best, Tyke Furlong, Ian Henderson, James Ryan, Peter O'Mahony, CJ Sandler at number 8, and Josh van der Fleer at the other wing forward. The wings are Jacob Stockdale and Keith Earls, with Rob Kearney at fullback, and Tomás mentioned that there, Robbie Henshaw and Gary Ringrose pair up with the halfbacks of Conor Murray and Johnny Sexton. Before we go in and kind of divulge into it a little bit, Tomás, just the bench, obviously no Sean Cronin being out of it, but one that we chatted to BJ about earlier on was Porter getting the head nod ahead of John Ryan.
Yeah, look, it's a big call, I suppose. The more experienced front row practitioners would all allude that maybe John Ryan is a bit ahead in his scrummaging experience and ability of Porter, but I suppose the raw size of Porter seems to have got him the nod, and you know he's probably a little bit more of a ball carrier on the pitch. So look, I suppose Joe Schmidt and Greg Feek obviously would see them day in, day out, and they're obviously very confident that Porter, although he's relatively inexperienced for an international prop, that he can stand up to the rigours of a test against New Zealand in a quarter final. So, look, it's a big nod of approval for him, and it's going to be a big test if he does come on after 60 minutes when the game is in the melting pot. So, look, hopefully he goes well.
One of the big positives is that all of the 15 starters have beaten New Zealand in the past, and Michael Corcoran actually spoke to Rory Best about the confidence that the players are getting from their recent Tier 1 encounters.
Yeah, I think it's something that we probably can't underestimate.
Beating anyone in the world, and, you know, we've said that, and I think to have now done that, you know, we've beaten, over the last number of years, we've beaten probably all of the Tier 1 teams and certainly any ones that we've played. But ultimately, this is a World Cup, this is a quarter-final, and this is a very different game than anything we've played against them. And they're also a team that you know that if they turn up and they play to the best of their ability, you're going to have to produce something very, very special to beat them. They're also a team that very rarely drops below a certain standard. So I think it's just a really exciting challenge for us to make sure that we're as good as we can be. And I think when we look at each other after the game, I think if we can say that was the best that we had to produce, I do think with this group of players that we'll be in a really, really good place.
Sorry, Tomás, I cut you off there to hear from Rory Best. But yeah, they've got so much experience heading into this encounter anyway.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's something that we can't underestimate, is that confidence that this Irish team will have. You know, two of the last three times, I think they've been victorious against them. And I suppose that element of doubt will inevitably, you know, come into the New Zealand minds if the game is in the melting pot, you know, 60, 70 minutes. They won't be so confident, you know, as New Zealand teams of the past may have been. And I suppose this Irish team is very settled, very experienced as well. And I suppose the same can't be said of the New Zealand team. You know, they've had a lot of decisions to make, you know, in around the centres. You know, their back three obviously isn't as experienced maybe as the Irish back three, obviously Beauden Barrett. But, you know, Sibu Rhys, you know, he was due to sign with Connacht, you know, and he 18 months ago as well. So look, it's a big test for New Zealand too, but obviously the calibre of players they have, and you know, the hot favourites they are, you know, you would expect that, you know, they'll have the ability to really put Ireland under pressure.
Just on the selections, you said it at the start, it's very much a Joe Schmidt team. There are players knocking on the door, the likes of Jordan Larmour, Andrew Conway. You look at the centres, Chris Farrell. As a player, Tomás, when the coach backs you like that, when Joe Schmidt puts his faith in you, if you're those players, how do you respond to that?
Yeah, look, I think, like Rory Best mentioned it there, you know, how excited the team are by this challenge, and you know, it's probably the biggest, you know, ever game in Irish World Cup history. You know, playing playing the All Blacks, defending champions in a World Cup, and a chance to progress to the semi-final. So that excitement level is going to be there. I think, you know, it is great to see the likes of Carberry, Lamar on the bench. You know, even Ruddock has had a bit of form. He's on the bench, so there seems to be a genuine impact option coming off the bench. But, you know, you go through the whole team, and I suppose the clamour for maybe a change of 15 or, like you mentioned, Farrell in centres maybe, or, you know, for, you know, Scannell maybe at two. You know, you look at Rob Kearney, you look at, you know, like the Rory Best, and even the, you know, the talker in the selection around Peter O'Mahony. You know, these guys have been there and done that, and in the bigger games, these guys seem to come to the fore. So I think, obviously, Schmidt has put his fate in that fact, and, you know, these players are big game players, so you know, they've proved it time and time again. So I think they're just going to be, you know, excited and I suppose looking to progress Ireland to a place that they've never been before.
And is that what we can expect? Can we expect like man of the match performances from the likes of Peter, Rob Kearney, Robbie Henshaw? Is that the level they have to reach now for Joe?
Yeah, look, I think this game, you know yourself, Dunnick, it's going to be decided. You know, the pack is going to have a big say in it, and particularly set piece. So if our set piece can function and we can, I suppose, get that, you know, go forward ball, whether it's off the top or using our maul to put pressure on New Zealand and supply this backline that we have with a chance to put pressure on New Zealand, I do think we'll have an advantage in the centres if we can get enough clean set piece ball, and if we can get enough dominance or parity even in the pack. And when you go through the pack, you know, you'd be confident enough that we can do that. Look, I suppose obviously they've got the likes of Retallick and Whitelock in the second row, which is a very formidable second row partnership. But, you know, Ian Henderson and James Ryan have been two of our probably better players too. And you know, the back row battle, you know, with, I suppose, Kieran Reid, Kane and Sevilla there, you know, whether we can come out on top there, I think that's going to go a long way towards whether we can win this game. And I think our ball carrying, we have to give a bit of support to CJ in that department.
Just, you mentioned their back row there, obviously Cody Taylor as well. It's hard to know which one of them is playing seven. He plays like a seven as well as a hooker. Do you think Steve Hansen has picked this team to run us off the park? Will he have seen how we beat them the last two times and identify that they have to have a better mobile game, a multi-phase game?
Yeah, look, I think the Kiwis will always try and back their skill set to beat teams and to overcome teams. And, you know, whether it's the, you know, the pace of play they're playing at and how wide they are. Like you said, you know, Sevilla will often be on the wings and waiting for the ball to come to him. And you know, he's a very dangerous runner. Cody Taylor, likewise. But I think they'll probably realise that, you know, in order to beat this Irish team, you have to physically match them and take them on. And I don't think you'll see New Zealand shying away from that. I think particularly, you know, the defeat, the last defeat will still rankle with them. And, you know, that will be seeping there for the last, you know, 12 months to build up to this World Cup, you know. So I think physically they'll be very confrontational, and I think they're going to meet fire with fire, and they're really going to, I suppose, embrace that physical challenge that Ireland bring. And I think any rugby game, obviously, is about that, you know, that contest, that, you know, at the breakdown and the tackle. So you'll see New Zealand really confront that, but definitely utilise space when they can to test this Irish defence.
Okay, let's hear from their head coach, Steve Hansen.
Through the competition, you earn respect from other people, and you... they earn yours, and you understand the trials and tribulations that they go through and the pressure they're under. So we get, you know, the odd opportunity to meet each other away from the battlefield. And, you know, they're like-minded people, aren't they? They're trying to improve a team that they're in charge of and make the most of, you know, their time with those athletes. So we've caught up with the Irish guys plenty of times in Dublin, and you know Andy really well, and obviously know Joe well. Greg Feek's another one; he's in their team. So and Simon Easterby, you know through my time in Wales. So if you hang around long enough, you get to know most of them. So But you know, once we get down to the park and you know, for 80 minutes, we'll go for it. And then afterwards, either way, you've just got to accept what's happened. That's what sport's about, isn't it? You know, it's called a test for a reason, and test your mental capacity and your physical capacity. Sport, like it, like life, is not always fair. So sometimes you're going to get the rub of the green, sometimes you're not. But I think the measure of your character is how you deal with either one of those things when the game's over.
That was Steve Hansen there, the New Zealand coach. Donica, he said that New Zealand, Ireland all know each other fairly well. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I think like what he's saying there is we're quite similar, and Tomás would have seen it over his time as well. Players that come into the Irish system seem to settle in very well. There's just, I know he's talking about respect, but the one I always go back to is Doug Howlett. He just comes in and he buys into an environment, and you know, they're from a small country as well, with a bit of a chip on their shoulder, agricultural kind of people as well, and you know, care about what they do. But I think that's as far as it'll stop with the terms and Steve Henson's kind of respect for Ireland. I've no doubt, Tomás, I'd love your take on it, what he'll be saying to get them ready for this Saturday. Like, he knows that we're a threat now after beating them twice.
Yeah, absolutely. I think probably the key, you know, and they'll target is obviously CJ Stander, make sure he doesn't get over the line, the gain line. Probably a bit too reliant on him in recent times, like I said, in terms of ball carrying. Definitely they'll put pressure on our halfbacks, and obviously our kind of game is generally dictated by Conor Murray and Sexton, and they won't want them to get you know, a lot of time to dictate, you know, the pace and tempo of the game, and obviously their kicking game, make sure they put that under pressure. That's an area that we've had success, you know, in recent years when we've gone to the air against them. You know, our wingers have come up or you know, knocked the ball back on our side. So I think that just that physical confrontation, like I said, they probably beat New Zealand up, Ireland beat New Zealand up in Dublin in our last victory, and that probably will kind of rankle with this New Zealand team. So I think it's just going to be a case of matching that, I suppose, physicality and structure that this Irish team does bring, and trying to, I suppose, create a more open game if possible, to let the broken field runners like I suppose Goodhue and Barrett and Reese into the game.
One thing that can be frustrating when you play or watch the All Blacks is their ability to give away cynical penalties at crucial times. And I watched back the game in Chicago when we won, and I saw breakdowns by Jordy Murphy and Donica Ryan. And I actually think in the new environment of refereeing, they could be red cards. You spoke about that physicality Ireland are going to have to bring. How important is Nigel Owens in all this?
Yeah, Nigel obviously is going to be key. And, you know, he's probably, you know, one of the better referees around out there, and in terms of sort of understanding the game and letting things flow. Obviously, look, if there is foul play, he'll deal with it, but he likes to let the game flow and kind of understands, I suppose, the spirit of the game as well. I know it's kind of you know, the laws of the game versus the spirit of the game, but he'd often reference that. And you know, if he sees something that isn't too cynical and is borderline, I think he likes to let things go. So so yeah, that the one worry then is, look, as you said, how willing New Zealand are to be cynical when they have to be. But I think most rugby teams, at the top teams anyway, most, I suppose, top teams in sport, are willing to sacrifice, whether it's take a yellow card or whatever, to give their team another chance to get settled and defend again and get back into structure. So, you know, if Nigel Owens and his team aren't, I suppose, refereeing the breakdown like they should be and letting stuff get away with, back rows in particular, get away with killing the ball and slowing the ball down, then obviously the defences will be on top. But, look, it's the same for both sides, so I'm sure there'll be no bias, or certainly no intentional bias at kind of leaving New Zealand away with more than it'll leave Ireland with. So, look, I don't think it's a worry. I think he's a great referee, and I think we'll have the best opportunity to see as open a game as possible. But obviously the confrontation nature of a quarter final might dictate that it's probably more structured than open.
Would you like to see him kind of go to his pocket straight away with yellow cards, rather than just a frustration for me at the moment, Tomás, is people are losing, have showing bad behaviours and cleaning out breakdowns, because, you know, they know this player's going to get away with it. So, like, if we're going to be hard on the player bringing the physicality, should we be really tough on the cynical player that's giving away the penalty that's leading to that?
Yeah, look, if it's definite and obvious cynical play, I'd like to see yellow card flash straight away. And I think, you know, most players would, most supporters would, most people, you know, involved in the game. I suppose if it's early on in a game, the danger is that a referee, you know, it doesn't go to his pocket. But hopefully, IRB will be dictating to referees that, you know, World Rugby will be dictating to them that, you know, if it's cynical foul or dangerous foul, you have to go to your pocket. And, you know, no better experienced referee than Nigel Owens to do that. I know he does like to let the game flow, and he kind of likes to, I suppose, have that kind of understanding with players. But if it is a cynical foul, and it does kind of, I suppose, give an advantage to the defensive team, hopefully he'll penalise that with a yellow card.
Tomás, we've had a text in for you into 51552. Do you think we'll miss Devon Toner against New Zealand? He was immense at the Ruck last November. His ground game was brilliant too, line out maul, etc.
Yeah, look, I suppose you will miss him in the line out. That is a definite area, you know, just his height and his ability to win the ball on himself is definitely, you know, it's a loss. You know, I referenced earlier, you know, the back row partnership though has been fantastic for us, and I don't think that Toner is brings anything superior than Henderson or Ryan around the pitch, whether it's in defence or attack or at the breakdown. But certainly in terms of line-out, you know, if we could afford to have him as an asset in the line-out, definitely it'd be great to have him there. But obviously the coaches and you know, the team have weighed up, you know, the strengths and weaknesses and just dictate that Henderson and Ryan are far superior maybe athletes and all around second rows than Toner. So unfortunately he's obviously going to be watching the game in Dublin, but certainly at line-out time he'd be a lovely I suppose asset to have.
Just on that, just chatting about the second rows, you know, James Ryan obviously coming up against the two best second rows in the world in Brody Retallick and Sam Whitelock. Just how important is this for him, Tomás, in terms of he's had big games against the likes of Cruz and Atoji and Alan Wynne-Jones and come out second best? You know better than anyone, to push on in rugby, you have to earn people's respect that you play against. This is a big game for James Ryan, isn't it?
Absolutely. Look, I suppose the first few years of his career really just were, you know, were almost dreamland stuff where, you know, he didn't lose a game for whatever, 2-3 years. And, you know, obviously that couldn't continue. But like you said, you know, they're real experienced, you know, old school almost second row partnership, you know, physically impressive, obviously intellectually very, very capable of managing a line out and, you know, dominating line-out. So, yeah, this is going to be probably the biggest test that these two guys, certainly as a partnership, Henderson and Ryan, have come across. You know, Retallick and Whitelock, I suppose Retallick has limited enough game time, but obviously they're confident that, you know, his experience and his ability, that they have to go with him for this game. So, look, you kind of obviously would have played against these two guys, and do you think that Henderson and Ryan have the ability to, I suppose, dominate them at line-out time?
It's just a combination I'd be more interested in, Tomás. I think that this kind of All Blacks one, they've played with each other a little bit more. I think the two lads are still finding their feet. Even small things like them saying that they're sharing the line-out calling, I don't like that. I like someone to take control of it. But I do know he's certainly, especially when it comes to James, he's certainly capable of being at their level, and I think it's a big game for him.
Oh, absolutely, and I suppose, look, Peter O'Mahony is there as well, you know, as an option to, you know, to assist and help in with the line-outs are going a bit awry and take over there. But yeah, I'd agree, you know, when, you know, obviously Paulie was there, whoever, you knew he was the boss man and he was calling the line-out, and, you know, if he went off, you know, there was a plan whoever's going to take over. But I suppose you like that, I suppose, definite nature when you come together in a huddle and, you know, your line-out caller dictates what's going to happen. There's no ifs or buts. So yeah, I think that's probably a good point and something probably I hadn't thought about as much.
You were never too worried about the front five anyway, Tomás. Listen, thanks a million for joining us. We've more with PJ both after 7, but we'll just take a quick break.
Game on on 2FM.
With Gillette, new SkinGuard Sensitive Razor. The first razor of its kind designed to stop irritation on sensitive skin. Gillette, the best a man can get.
Welcome back to Game On with Marie and Dunica. So Special Congress is fast approaching, and yesterday we heard from some players who are not in favour of the introduction of a two-tier championship. Today we will hear from an administrator in favour of the proposal. Declan Bone, Leitrim PRO, joins us on the line. Declan, how are things down in Leitrim?
Oh, not too bad now. We're keeping our heads above water, I suppose you could say, at this time of the year, you know.
Of course, and it's a busy time of year at this time because there's always lots of things happening off the pitch, and one of them is Special Congress on Saturday. So Leitrim are going to vote in favour of the two-tier proposal, if I'm correct, Declan?
That's correct, yeah. We had our county board meeting back there a number of weeks ago, and the decision of that particular meeting was that we would support the proposals for a tier two system going forward, you know, because... I suppose that the reasons are varied and many. Our record, I suppose, over qualifiers over the last, 19 years since it has come in, you know, wouldn't be anything to write home about. And, you know, we've spent the majority of that period of time in Division 4. Now, we were fortunate this year to get out of Division 4 and into Division 3. But, you know, the reality of it is that the qualifier system, as it has been, hasn't really served us very well. From our point of view, looking at it, you know, it is, I suppose you could say, the proverbial road to nowhere, because inevitably it ends in our demise, if you like, in each championship season. We've only actually won 4 qualifier games in the 19 years, you know. And I suppose the other aspect of it is that we're playing in a very, very competitive kind of championship at the moment, with 3 of our opponents in Connacht having tasted Super 8 action over the last 2 seasons. Alone gives you an indication of, you know, how difficult it is for us to progress, you know.
Absolutely. And have you spoken to the players about what they want?
Well, I suppose at the time that when our season was at a high, if you like, last spring, while we were finishing off our league campaign, which we were delighted with and so on, at that stage, yeah, the players would have been in favour of it. Now, I'm well aware of the fact that, you know, the sands of time have brought various forces, I suppose, you know, to militate, maybe, if you like, against this move. I know that there have been moves, you know, to right across the country, I suppose, for the players' body, you know, to oppose it. But from our point of view, no formal decision, if you like, was taken by the players. That has to be stated in fairness. They wouldn't want to be misleading information or otherwise. But, you know, from the county's point of view, from the way we viewed it, we're in favour of it. We think it's the best road forward for all concerned.
What are the benefits to Leitrim from both the board and the players' point of view, Declan?
Well, I suppose the bottom line is that, you know, players, when they prepare for competition, you know, they need to have a reasonable chance, if you like, of seeing success at the end of it, you know. And as I alluded to earlier, you know, from the point of view of our competitive record in championship over the last 25 years, I suppose, and that seems like taking a large chunk of time. This year, it's 25 years since we won the Connacht Championship. And in that period of time, you know, with all due respect, leave aside the games we played against London and New York in the Connacht Championship, we've only actually had 3 championship victories on home soil in 25 years and 4 qualifier victories in matches, if you like. So, you know, if you add that up and just take it at the face of it, the reality of it is that, you know, for players going forward, you know, given the competitive nature of the Connacht Championship and given the qualifier system as it is, you know, there isn't much chance really at the moment of there being silverware at the end of the any season's work. You know, so from the players' point of view, or from players heading into a season, to have a reasonable chance of having a crack at some trophy, albeit we'd say a tier two competition, you know, would be beneficial for them, and we would feel that it would bring them on leaps and bounds. But, you know, the other side of that is that we would be very conscious of the fact that, you know, we would be urging and hopeful and, you know, demanding, if you like, that the promotion of that competition would be on an equal par with the Tier 1, you know.
We saw the Tommy Murphy Cup come and go, and it is pretty much, I suppose, this is very, very similar to that. What makes you think that something that didn't work before and was scrapped could work this time?
Well, I think that, you know, if we were to go back to the Tommy Murphy Cup, and you know, in 2006 we actually qualified for the final of it. it didn't work because there just didn't seem to be enough of buy-in into it. And the other aspect of it, I suppose, and many inter-county managers of that time would have pointed to the fact that, you know, because it was confined to Division 4 teams only, it almost made it, if you like, exclusively benign in a way. And many inter-county managers at that stage would have made the point that, you know, it shouldn't have been a bottom 8, it should have been a bottom 12 or a bottom 16 competing for it, and maybe that would have made it successful. So this is a second opportunity, you know, to make that happen, if you like. And I suppose, obviously, players like to have the big day out and they like to be playing against the big boys and all that type of thing. You know, we need to take a leap of faith now and, you know, put it in place. Because look at, we'll say, for example, what happens in every county all over the country in terms of the organisation of their own internal championships. There's no way that you would put all of the clubs of a particular county, any county you like to take, be they strong or be they not so strong, into the one championship. And it works for hurling, okay. This year, our senior hurlers were lucky to win the Lorimar Cup, and it was a great day for them and a great experience for them, and a sense of fulfilment at the end of the season. And you know, we'd be hopeful that, you know, if the second tier competition is successful and comes in and is promoted properly, that there'd be days like that to look forward to, not necessarily for us, but for many other counties also.
Declan, are we dropping the standards, though, just for young boys in Leitrim who grow up wishing and hoping to lift the Sam Maguire? You know, a Tommy Murphy Cup, you know, without being disrespectful, it's not the dream as you grow up and play football.
No, I would agree with you on that. I mean, that's a very valid point. But, you know, it shouldn't be forgotten in this that, you know, the footballers of Leitrim or the footballers of any other county that finds itself in Division 3 or 4 still have the opportunity of playing for Sam Maguire, because at the end of the day, when the provincial championships commence, you know, if that ambition is there and if that ability is there, that route into the Tier 1 competition is still open to every county starting off. And, you know, our take on it, and I'm sure everybody else's take on it would be the same, that certain aspects of this division, if you like to put it that way, of counties into two tiers, does not necessarily take away the opportunity of playing in Tier 1, because, you know, the draws are done for next year's Connacht Championship and for Munster Championship and so on. Every county still has that opportunity of playing for Sam Maguire on their first day out, second day out, third day out, and as they progress. So that route has not been taken away in proposing this plan. It's just that at a certain stage, you'll be diverted into a competition that, you know, may be more meaningful for you, and that you're more likely to experience maybe some success in.
Okay, thanks very much for joining us, Declan. We will find out on Saturday whether that proposal or not goes through. Now, also on Saturday, there are some playing rules up for review. I spoke to journalist Damien Lawler and also to Offaly footballer Niall McNamee about them.
Game on 2FM.
With Gillette, new skin guard sensitive with unique skin guard technology, taking the pressure off the blades and your shave. Say bye to shave irritation. Gillette, the best a man can get.
Welcome back to Game On. I'm playing tricks on poor old Marie here, pressing wrong buttons and throwing her completely off sort. We're meant to hear from Declan Lawler and who else?
Damien Lawler and Niall McNamee. Hopefully we'll hear from this time.
Give it a go.
Game On.
Gaelic football.
Damien, three motions to be discussed. The advance mark, it seems like one that should probably get the go-ahead. What are your thoughts on that one?
I think it's good. I mean, I watched Colin McShane and Matty Donnelly more so than any other players in Ireland absolutely thrive under it, and actually got Tyrone attacking again, and it was good to watch. People will say it's breaking momentum of Gaelic football in a sport that doesn't need further momentum to be broken, but no, I think it's actually encouraging a skill of our game further forward. But Niall, to me, you might say to me, Niall, no, I depend on quick ball, I don't like this rule, or this actually might help me get on the ball a lot more, so you'd know better than I would.
Yeah, but it's funny, this year I suppose with the league, I know I come on as a sub against Carlow, I think it was my second game back this year, and very first ball that was kicked in was a mark, just about 21 metres out. And I suppose the way the game has changed in terms of people, a lot of players have been dropped back and stuff, it does keep defences honest in terms of if you're kept in close to goal, if someone can hit it at 40 yard pass and or whatever metres it is, but if it says outside the 45, you are a threat on the edge edge of the square. Mm. We are a threat in close to goal, and it could prolong a lot of guys' careers as well. Being honest, because, you know, it does add that extra dimension to the game where players might be able to get away with it a little bit more.
And Marie, you've seen like Donaghy back in the mid noughties, Quirk, all these, you know, Cusson, Webster, all these towering lads bring more drama and excitement to games, and there is now a role for them in the intercounty game where coaches might have felt they weren't mobile, and not the guys I mentioned, but that template. It's exciting, I think it'll come true as well.
There'll be coaches now at basketball courts trying to scout players. And we had David Goff actually on Game On recently enough, and he was talking through the rules, so let's hear from him.
It's a huge challenge. I mean, that rule book is not an easy thing to become an expert in. And we have 40 odd aggressive fouls that are specific just to contact and players, and to know all of them inside out, to understand them, to be able to reflect on them, and to be able to call them from memory is a huge asset.
They're definitely going to have a tough task if they have some more rules to bring in as well. Yeah. And Niall, the sin bin, would you be in favour of that one?
I think I would, yeah. Again, it adds something new to the game as well, you know, even from a coaching point of view, because you have so many things going on in terms of if it's your own player that's getting into a sin bin, well, how are you going to adapt to it? What are you going to set up? How are you, before the game, pre-plan things? If someone does end up getting into the sin bin, are we dropping X amount of players? Are we going to play with two or three up front? Are we going to stay the way we are? And even as the opposing team then, having an extra man in the field, how are they going to utilise that as well? So, in terms of... Yeah, I think in terms of from a black card point of view, I think it's a better option. I think it has more of an effect. I think it's a better punishment for a crime. I'd say
about 20 years ago, Marie, it was actually in place. Pat Daly brought it in, and they didn't stick with it.
2004, I think wasn't it?
They only lasted about like 6 weeks. I think one of the high profile managers gave out about it, and that was it. Gone a few weeks later, and I think there was a bit of criticism that the linesman had too much officiating and paperwork to do. But I think you just appoint somebody to, you appoint a sin bin manager for want of a to look after the likes of McNamee when he's over there every 2 games or so.
And then the third one. Kick-outs taken from the centre point of the 20-metre line, it must travel forward, Niall.
Yeah, love that one. In terms of, it's funny, I was chatting to a goalkeeper recently, and he was actually saying how difficult it is at the moment on the 14-yard line to get it out past the 21. With players, teams pushing up and stuff, that was very, very difficult. And a lot of players as well struggle with a long kick as well, and it actually will add an advantage for a team to get further out from goal. No, I think that's a very, very... I think it's an easy one.
Game on, GAA.
Now, so that was a chat there about the rules that are going to be reviewed at Special Congress on Saturday. So we will find out whether or not they come through. Donica, we've had some text in to 51552. Do you think Stockdale has had a quiet tournament and that maybe Larmer is unlucky not to be starting?
Yes. Sorry, that is you're on the money there. Brilliant message. Totally agree, and I even think Andrew Conway is unlucky not to be involved. Just back to Tomás's point, though, this is Joe's team. Joe's picked them to put out. Jacob Stockdale needs to have a massive game. He needs to repay the faith. So yeah, I totally agree with that.
Okay, now we are going to go to football. La Liga has asked El Clasico to be switched from Barcelona's Nou Camp to Real Madrid's Bernabeu over fears of civil unrest. Football journalist Fergal Brennan joins me on the line. Fergal, what's been happening with that?
Well, essentially that's a bit of a tough one to answer. The situation as it stands is that La Liga have contacted the Spanish FA, the RFEF, to request either a postponement or a change of venue. As it stands, both clubs are against that potential move. Barcelona have released an official statement to say that they're not in favour of the game being moved from the Camp Nou in Barcelona to the Bernabeu or to any other potential ground in Spain. But as it stands, it's the league that has brought the case to the authorities to say that we are concerned. We've received reports from the Catalan police that they're concerned over their ability to police a game of this profile, given the issues and problems that they're facing currently in the city at the moment. As it stands, things are kind of in a little bit of a lockdown in terms of a decision. Both clubs have said, we don't want it to be postponed or moved. If it has to be, we'll cross that bridge in the coming days. Barcelona have been a bit more forceful in their comments and basically saying that, no, we will oppose it, whereas Real Madrid have essentially said, we will keep an open mind about what happens and see what happens in the next few days.
They obviously have to do the right thing for people's safety as well, though. So what they're looking to do here is actually swap the fixtures, is it? They're looking to... Barca were meant to be at home, so then they move to Madrid, and that will then swap the later game in the league.
Essentially, yeah. So the return leg of this would be, I think it's currently scheduled for mid-March. Anyone that follows Spanish football will know that the changing of kickoff times to suit television, you know, is even more crazy than Premier League football. But yes, that would essentially be the way that they'll be looking at it. But that's also raises its own issues, because Barcelona have commented and said that if there's an objection to that from Real Madrid, or for example, you know, that could well be the game that decides the title, and we're talking about March time, they you know, have kind of prepared for that to be an away game, that could then be a home game. But as you say, it's an issue with regards to safety and security. This is the most high profile game in La Liga. The police have to be confident that they're in a position to secure fan safety, not just in and around the ground, but in the city centre. One of the main focuses of the civil protest in the last few days has been train stations and metro stations. If thousands of fans are coming from Madrid for the game, the police have to be in a position to safeguard Barcelona fans, Real Madrid fans, and people just going about their business in Barcelona city centre. And as things stand, they've come out and said they're not confident unless the situation comes more under their control in the next few days.
Are they not kind of drawing more attention to it, though? I mean, if you say, like, OK, we're not going to do this because of what's happening on the streets, will that not just make the people on the streets target this match?
Potentially, yeah. And I think that's, from the police's point of view, that's the concern. That, from the protest point of view, that's an ideal shop window, as it were, to further their case for gathering more widespread and more international interest into the case, which has seen 12 Catalan separatist politicians jailed in the last few days. Barcelona have not really sat on the fence in this situation. They've, you know, condemned the decision. They've come out and said that they will support any sort of appeal. So I do see what you mean, that there is going to be, all eyes are going to be on this game anyway. The attention levels have been ramped up, and I do believe that this would be a case where there would be protests outside the ground, because the eyes of the footballing world will be on that game.
Does this need to be taken out of Barcelona's hands, though, because of the standing they have in the Catalan region? Is this an impossible thing for them to step away from?
I do agree with that, but I think in terms of the game, it won't be Barcelona's decision. As much as Barcelona have objected to this and Real Madrid have kind of stayed a little bit more neutral, the decision will be made by the league. If the league have it ratified by the FA, the decision will be, as you say, essentially taken out of Barcelona's hands in terms of when the game is played, where the game is played. But in order for that to come to pass, the Spanish FA has to agree with La Liga's request, and La Liga also have to bring evidence to say that the police's concerns are founded. And we're talking about a game that isn't due to happen until next Saturday lunchtime. So in that space of time, 10 days or so, things could have changed in either direction. So I think the message from the Spanish FA at the moment and from the clubs is, let's pick this up next week and we see where we are in terms of a security position.
So then we're just going to move to Rio, where a politician there is trying to get VAR banned. What's happening over there?
Well, this you're right in saying this is a very unusual but fairly crazy story. Obviously, VAR has been a massive topic of discussion so far this season. People are fans of it. People are massively against it. But a politician in Rio, Antonio de Azevedo, has come out and criticised it following a whole host of decisions in the opening weeks of the Brazilian season that VAR has basically featured in every big game so far this season. His comments on it are more on an emotional level. He's talked about how football brings joy to the people of Brazil, how VAR is spoiling it for everybody. He's essentially said, we don't know what's going to happen in games now. Do we celebrate a goal? Is a game finished? What happens here? So he has raised the point that, you know, I think we've all heard or we might all sympathise with, in terms of how do we watch football now when we don't really know whether a goal is going to be ruled out or that type of thing. But it's a very strange way of doing this. He's, you know, politics and football, as we've just discussed, do tend to go hand in hand. But in this scenario, he's essentially trying to bring about a law that would outlaw VAR's use for any teams that are based in Rio, but those teams would still be subject to VAR when they played away from home. It's a very strange situation.
Thanks, Fergal. I'd say a lot of politicians who are looking for votes now will be looking around to see if they can get VAR outlawed in their cities. I'd say it would be very popular, make a lot of politicians very popular.
Ban VAR.
Okay, now to motorsports. And after Mercedes won their sixth title in a row, has Formula One turned into a bit of a procession once more? We spoke to Formula One journalist Declan Quigley, and he reminded us how the storm impacted the race.
Yeah, well, it was a great weekend if you wanted a day off, because the typhoon did indeed impact big time on the Japanese Grand Prix last Sunday, Marie, because they didn't run in qualifying on the Saturday, no running at all. Then they ran qualifying on the Sunday morning. And lo and behold, the Ferraris, who had been incredibly slow on Friday, suddenly vaulted to the head of affairs. Sebastian Vettel found some form that he hadn't had in recent races, 2/10 quicker than the nearest of the Mercedes. But then he blew the start, and then his teammate Charles Leclerc ran into Max Verstappen at the second corner. So suddenly the Ferraris are out of it, and the Mercedes just cruised to a 1-3 victory, which ultimately meant that with Valtteri Bottas in first and Lewis Hamilton in third, that Mercedes took their sixth consecutive Constructors' Championship, and that's four races early. So it's increasing and continued dominance of the Mercedes team. It also means that a Mercedes driver will win this year's Drivers' World Championship.
Declan, just on it, obviously you spoke about the Ferraris blowing their start. But it was the type of race that if you got off to a powerful start, it was nearly done and dusted at that point.
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah, Suzuka is an amazing racetrack to drive. I mean, it's one of the most challenging tracks on the calendar, but it's not the easiest track to overtake on. They've just got one DRS point, which is that point on the track where you can. It's sort of, some people say it's artificial, but the way that the wings work at that point, it's easier to overtake. And so, yeah, there's not a lot of overtaking at that race. So it wasn't maybe the most exciting, but it was a bit disappointing for Ferrari fans, for neutral fans, for those that would like to see maybe some more teams coming into the mix. But for all that, it was a great win by Valtteri Bottas, and he really needed it.
Is the dominance of Mercedes making Formula One a bit boring? Like, or is that just a bit of an exaggeration because people want that bit of variety?
Yeah, no, absolutely. It is a concern. It's the sixth consecutive year that Mercedes are going to secure both championships. It's a remarkable feat. It's never been done before. We have had periods of dominance through the years. I mean, everyone remembers the McLaren years of the 1980s. Williams in the early 1990s were so dominant, even in the early years of Formula One. It's always been the way. There have been dominant teams, but you've got a hierarchy of Mercedes with a bit of an edge, Ferrari coming with a bit of a run, and Red Bull are thereabouts. And they're the only three teams that have won 17 races this year, 12 of them won by Mercedes. Ferrari in the mix increasingly in recent races, Red Bull thereabouts. But the other midfield teams are incredibly closely packed. It's a really great scrap behind those three teams, but unfortunately at the moment it's not for the win.
Text 51552.
Game on. Weekdays from 6.
So since we spoke to Declan, Formula One has confirmed that it is preparing to publish its planned 2021 regulations by the end of this month. So it'll be interesting to see what changes, if any, these have on the sport. Now we will hear from BJ Botha and Paul McShane after 7, but first the news and ads.
Game on 2FM.
With Gillette Skin Guard Sensitive, the first razor of its kind designed to stop skin irritation. Revolutionary technology, taking the pressure off the blades and your shave. Gillette, the best a man can get.
Game on, rugby.
It's always nice to chat to someone who's been there and won the medals. BJ Botha won 25 caps for South Africa, and he was a cornerstone of that formidable pack that won the World Cup in 2007. BJ, how are you?
Good, Donis. How are you keeping?
I'm great. Look, we're speaking to Paul Sol earlier on, but I'd really like to focus on the South Africa-Japan game for you. Just your take on the South African selection.
Yeah, I suppose the team that's been selected is the same team that played against Italy. It's the kind of the 6-2 split really on the bench, as we see. Again, showing the physicality that the South Africans want to bring to the game, and I think it's needed against a very dangerous Japanese side. I suppose they've been building some momentum, but not really been tested other than the big game against New Zealand. So I think this is probably their next kind of, I suppose, big game since New Zealand, that they know they're going to be tested in all areas of the game. So they need to you know bring that to the game.
What do you think South Africa will have learned from watching what happened against Ireland and Scotland, what Japan are capable of?
I suppose in one sense South Africa played Japan in a pre-World Cup game. They were 2 weeks before the tournament started. They obviously then played them, in the World Cup. I suppose watching those games, it just shows, you know, the dangerous side they are. I suppose the engines they got on them, they incredibly fit side, well coached by Jamie Joseph, you know, and you know they've got this belief. I suppose they show on the field through both those games, and they are a top side and going to be difficult to beat.
BJ, South Africa have learned this lesson themselves 4 years ago. They've seen Ireland, they've seen Japan. They're not going to take the bait. They're not going to try to play this high-tempo game. And like you said there, to explain to people at home, a 6-2 split means that they've gone with six forwards on their bench and two backs. They're going to take them on physically, aren't they?
Exactly, and wear them down. I suppose the tight phases, you know, are going to be massive. That just takes time, and I suppose this side is this side, meaning Japan, they're incredibly effective with ball in hand, attacking, and similar on defence. But I suppose the one part that Ireland didn't really test them was in the scrum and in the maul. They couldn't get that going, and I suppose South Africa will definitely target that side, and then the physicality they bring around the ruck. So they'll know that, I suppose, from a 6-2 split, that at about the 45-50 minute mark, they'll bring on fresh legs, and the guys that are coming off the bench, the Kitsoffs, the Malcolm Marks, are guys that have started, you know, in some of the rugby championships games up front, and they know what's needed.
I mentioned to Donegh earlier, BJ, that Japan's pack had been scrummaging against 10 players in training to try and simulate the power of the Springboks pack, and he told me it was a completely futile exercise. What were your thoughts?
Yeah, I agree. I suppose for me, it's all in the, when the guys go live, it's the kind of tension that's built up. I suppose the nerves around that, it's about combinations. It's all in while preparing for that, but I think that's a kind of a long time coming. I suppose you need to be really reactive and to see how that happens in the game and adapting through that. And scrummaging is about confidence really within the game, building that momentum through the scrum, through the tight phases, and then adjusting to the ref and pushing that envelope as far as you can.
There's no one better to speak about scrummaging. I've been lucky enough to play with you. It's an art form that you've excelled at. What have you made of Japan scrummaging, though?
Yeah, Japan are interesting. I suppose, again, that was a big surprise how they came at the Irish scrum. And again, I think that one scrum, I think it's in the Irish game, it was about the 32 minute mark where, you know, they really came at Ireland and probably a big turning point in the game, and that's what it is really. It's a weapon, I suppose, that can turn a game, you know. And they are a formidable scrum. I suppose in one sense it depends how much pressure they are put on as well, and how much ascendancy they do get there, because again, that's what I talk about adapting. I suppose once you feel the pressure in a scrum, you know, certain elements then break away, you know, your connections break away, the tension really weakens, and I suppose then the guys are looking around and what's next. I suppose that's when you're in the danger zone. So South Africa would want to push them in that direction, but I think again they'll be up for it, and I think we'll see a real contest in the first a couple of scrums, and then we'll see. I believe the South Africans then will take over.
You spoke about the pre-World Cup game against Japan and how South Africa will make it a set-piece battle, a confrontational, physical game. How will we judge that? How will you know that they're trying to play this game compared to Japan's open, expansive running game?
Yeah, I think we will see it definitely in the first 5 minutes of the game. I suppose we saw it in the Italian game, how the guys came out just really manhandling the guys around the ruck, getting off on top of them and really making the guys get off the ground, work hard to get around the corner on defence. And I suppose we'll probably see the guys start off with a strong mauling action and if they do have a line out and going for the corner. But in the other sense, I suppose they also know it's cup rugby. The South Africans are aware of that. They've been there before. A lot of these players, you know, playing top tournaments, they've been there before. They know 1 point wins the game and puts them through to the semi-final. So it'll also be, I think, that whole battle of the error rate. They don't want to be giving away silly penalties and obviously back off the momentum that they're building through that, you know.
This is the test for Japan, though, isn't it? Everyone has seen them beat teams with the running game. Can they answer the best at a set-piece battle?
Yeah, I think this will be definitely the test. You know, I think we've seen, you know, how they've shown. They're just incredible. You know, as I said, I mentioned, I think the biggest thing that hits home for me is how fit they are. They just keep on coming at you, how they build the phases, how they know each other in their kind of backline and forward connections, and knowing where to be. But I think this is one probably if they do lack something in their game, it would be what South Africa does best, you know. And I think we'll probably see that South Africa will come with that. And it's the stats show that South Africa's territory and possession is quite low with the teams they play against, you know. And hence the fact that they're trying to just squeeze you into that position of after three or four phases, you're giving away a penalty because of the massive momentum they're driving from their physicality, the breakdown, the scrum or the line-out.
It's back-to-back massive tests as well for Japan, so just physically I'm sure it'll be tough to kind of keep going with such a short break against such a massive team.
Yeah, I think that is true, but I think just the game itself will probably lift the guys. They'll find the energy somewhere, you know. I think that's just the adrenaline will be pumping. It'll probably be a packed stadium in Japan and everyone else will be shouting for Japan and world rugby, I suppose. And I think everyone will be shouting and just really been obviously shouting for them as they've been progressing through the stages and just what it's been doing for Japan rugby and the Japanese people itself, I suppose. But they'll pick themselves up. But I don't think they'll have enough there, you know, to kind of give any problems from a result perspective for the South Africans.
Just from Razzie's point of view then, going in kind of everyone shouting for Japan, will he like that kind of mindset of it's us against everyone?
Definitely. And I think they'll drive that home, you know. It'll be a nice, tight unit, you know. That's what World Cups have been about. It's been about the 43, you know, including the management, including the coaching staff, including the analysis. It's about that unit that stick together. And I suppose that's what makes it kind of quite unique going to a World Cup. And they make their little town, you know, South Africa or whatever the case may be, and they feel that support from that perspective. But I think it's keeping that, you know, really in between themselves and, you know, knowing the hard work that's been done before. I think, you know, and leading up to the World Cup is important. They know, and only they know what they've done and prepared for, and this is hopefully will bear the fruits of that.
Of course, Felix is in there as well. BJ, have you heard anything about how he's getting on in the backroom team?
Yeah, I think he's not new to the backroom team either, you know, being with Munster, with all of them, most of them anyway. I think he's just relishing the opportunity, I suppose, working with a team like South Africa and, you know, the kind of with Arlid again, back in the days when he was our S&C in Munster. So I think he's really enjoying it, I suppose. Who wouldn't, you know? And I think it would have been very interesting that they still might meet with a South African-Irish clash. I think everyone was speaking about that. That was going to be interesting. Him having the knowledge on both sides, but I think they, you know, who knows, they might meet still yet. But I think he's just loving it.
It's amazing what Razzie has done with the South African team in such a short space of time. You spoke about the people he's put in around him, but his time in Ireland, did he learn maybe structures and things he could put in place to help South African rugby to get back to where it belongs?
Definitely. I think part of that was definitely that. I think you saw the structures that RFU used, the structures with Munster, player management, and using that, you know, that platform. I suppose also bringing through new talent and nurturing that, and also selecting on form and not being scared to make that decision. I think the World Cup is a lot about form and kind of getting players in a place where they're going to be really right for those six or whatever weeks they might be involved in the World Cup, you know. So he's been kind of massive in that. I suppose the decisions that they've made with SA Rugby have not been easy, I suppose, and also other clubs with players that are tied in international side of things. So it's taken a lot of work to get the guys together, but I think they've been playing us for a long time, as all the teams have been. But Russie would have, I think, learned definitely part of what his time over here has played a big part.
There's always someone behind the scenes that players have a whole respect for and want to play well for. And Jaco Nienberg, his time at Munster, you just knew the Munster lads loved him. South Africa's defence has been incredible. What have you made of him? What have you made of South Africans D?
Yeah, Jaco Nienberg.
Thank you.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm working on my Afrikaans names.
100%. Yeah, I know. He's really been massive. And I suppose, you know, where Rusty goes, he goes, and where Yaku goes, Rusty goes. I suppose they just make a massive combination. You know, Yaku's got a massive, you know, knowledge of analysing, and he's a physio as much as he is that as well, and just a team man, and he's really passionate about that, and he brings that aggression from a defensive perspective, and that's where the South Africans bring their physicality and mostly make their statement, as you know, from that's where the guys, and eventually anyway, the big games are won. So he'll make sure that that physicality and that aggression is brought about, and really their defensive system shows where how they come off the line and really forcing the guys to come inside so they can make those big impacts and really try and turn over and really cause havoc at the breakdown. And he's been, you know, as I said, as you've mentioned now, massive there. And I suppose it's just the finer things that you know, they you know, as a player at that level, I think that's what you relish, that contact. But it's again just organizing that, making that system work in you know, more seamless, and I suppose, you know, guiding them on that.
What have you made so far of South Africa's World Cup? Obviously a disappointing loss to New Zealand at the start, but are they gathering momentum at the right time?
Yeah, I think it's important to note that, you know, New Zealand was obviously a massive game first out. I think a lot of the things that happened in that game were due to errors that we made, you know, uncharacteristic errors from South Africa, you know, missed tackles. But again, then they also had that, and we had our time in the game to go ahead. One or two I don't want to mention, but it looks like it's been a part and parcel of the World Cup so far, the refs. But look, you know, the refs reffing both the sides. And then they would have taken, obviously, little bit of a knock there. They would have definitely wanted to get over that one. They would have put them in the driving seat, which you always want to be in a World Cup. You don't want to be relying on other results, because that just sits in the back of the head there while you're preparing and trying to build that momentum, which is massive. I suppose the position they find themselves in now is, I think, probably the best position they could be in. They've got a roundabout clean bill of health. Chesney Colby and a few of the other guys they were worried about have come through that now, which is massive for World Cup, having your players together, and then obviously having the guys build some momentum through Italy, and obviously not coming too unscathed through Canada and through the other side now when they prepare now for Japan.
Colby has been one of the standout players of the Rugby World Cup. What have you made of him? This guy is magical, isn't he?
Yeah, just incredible. You know, I think the guys who followed, he's obviously playing in Toulouse, just been massive for Toulouse, you know, and then just continuing that with the South African form within that unit and being allowed to do that. I think sometimes you get in, change teams and coming to the national squad and you're restricted, but he's been allowed to do that. You know, what's really been, it's great that he's still part of the South African side, of course, most importantly, but he's also just such a great player to have at the World Cup, so it would have been a shame to see him leave. He just lights up the field and everyone likes to see him, obviously, you know, doing that. I suppose what's really been the point for me that to note is his defence, you know, really just so sound on defence and really knowing his place, where to be. Obviously, his attacking ability is there to see for everyone, and we know that, but his defence and rounding that off, it just gives that little bit of, you know, extra edge to South Africa, you know, kind of known for their physicality and taking them out up front. And then you get this guy, Cheslin, running circles around the guys when they're kind of just dragging and actually going for a big hit, but he just dances around them. So I suppose just bringing that side of things as well and just mixing it up, I think, yeah, he's been huge for South Africa and, as I mentioned now, for the World Cup.
We spoke about Razzy there taking ideas from the structure within the RFU, but he's gone outside the South African playing pool with players like that and De Klerk at nine. Do you, it just from being a player within the system, playing with Ulster and Munster, do you believe that's something the Irish squad should do, or should they protect the playing pool within Ireland?
It's a difficult one, you know. I think there's definitely a balance. I think there's players that add to the team and add to the upcoming players. I think that experience is lost. I think you need to use that, you know. I think those players that are brought in, Frans Steyn, for instance, you know, World Cup winner in 2007, you know, bringing that calmness into a squad, you know, being there, done that, you know, and especially in a bit leading up to a big tournament. However, I think it's a balance on the other side of things where they need to bring that youth through and use the international window period, whether it be the Six Nations or whatever, to to decide, listen, yeah, we're going to use the guys in Ireland that have bought into our system, yeah, and then they plan forward to the World Cup or whatever competition they might be coming up. So I think it's a real fine balance. I think there's always this challenge for players leaving and then all staying. You know, you have all these kind of decisions to make from a family, from a financial, from all the stuff that a professional player you have to make. So it is very difficult, but I think it's a balance, and I think there's definitely scope for that for a player to be selected if he's playing abroad and he still wants to and believe he can still, you know, add to the national side.
I know he drove you nuts at times, but Simon's able.
Yeah, Simon, look, I think Simon has got something special, you know, as you say, he drove me nuts and
he drove us on nuts.
Yeah, exactly. And what he gets up to, but he's, you know, kind of, as I said, he's the X factor, I suppose, I look at it, you know, and someone you couldn't even analyze, you know, coming into a game, and his strength, he found from somewhere, wriggling out two, three players tackling him, even me running on the field seeing that. And look, he's a special player, but I think it's at the end of the day, it's how he fits into that national side and going forward. And I think those decisions need to be kind of made by the coach and the coaching staff leading up to that. But there's always someone that's gonna miss out. And there's probably on the South African side a few guys that have as well missed out on there. But as I said, all you can do as a player is put your hand up, I suppose, put yourself in that position to be selected, force the selector's hand, and if you go, you're ready to play, you know, and if you're not, then you obviously put your head down wherever you've decided to go and give it your best shot.
I know this weekend you'll obviously be shouting for both teams in green, and I'd love your view on, especially with your expertise, the Irish front row. What have you made of Keane Healy, Rory Best and Tadhg Furlong?
Yeah, of course. For me, it's a great front row, I suppose. I think it's our best front row at this stage, I suppose, and the competition is massive up front at the moment. Taking a step back there, I suppose, for me, David Kilcoyne have added massive when he's come off the bench, and I suppose in one sense you need some continuity up front there. John Ryan, for me, has also added when he's come off the bench and got opportunity. But for me, it's about combinations, you know, up front. Look, at times they've been under pressure. We've seen a Japanese game. We've seen it in a few other games. They've been under pressure there. But again, this team, it seems, especially that front row, when they played against, I think that front row also played against all Blacks last time, you know, they rose up to the occasion. And also it's about the teams they play against. The All Blacks scrum quite similar to the Ireland setup, you know, they've quite a kind of similar setup, and so they do rise up to that. But again, it's about combinations and continuity there. I'm not saying that the guys can't add to it, but I think it's probably our best combination at this stage for the guys playing together and going forward. But I can't wait to see Kilcoyne, David and these guys coming off the bench, you know, and adding to that.
Well, you spoke about Kilcoyne's impact from the bench. Porter is preferred over John Ryan, and he's able to play both tight and loose. Can you explain to people listening how difficult that is to do?
Yeah, very difficult. I think especially at this level, you know, you kind of, as a prop, you come through the age groups, and basically at some stage when you into the 20s, early 20s, you need to make a decision really from a playing perspective. If you're going to be playing loose-head and tight-head, it's completely different roles. The one tight-head position, obviously scrumming on two shoulders, and you're literally wedged in between the loose-head and the hooker's head. So you've got no problem with your angle coming in. You kind of nice and straight, where at the loose head, you really need to work hard on the left side of your body and work hard to stay straight and obviously get your opposition number three under pressure. So completely different, and someone to be able to do that at that level is quite exceptional, you know, to play at that level. I suppose, yeah, I would like to have seen more of John Ryan. I'm not a massive fan of. I'm not a massive fan of making a player one and a three. Mm-hmm. I think it's great for a coach. I think it's great for a team to have that. But I suppose from a specialist perspective, and if I think from a player's perspective, a player wants to specialise, I think he can go just that much further and maybe a little bit sooner. Because I think coaches like to have those options, you know, at hand. You know, covering one and three if they need them.
Can you explain? Because everyone listening, you know, they always look and they think Conor Murray, Johnny Sexton, they're the heartbeat of the teams. But you know when you're in it, how important a tight head is. How important is Tadhg Furlong to this team?
Yeah, he's definitely, he's literally the spine of the scrum, really. I say everything really formulates through that. I mean, at times you could probably see that a tight head's position is under so much tension. The loose head and the hooker might be coming up on his side, and he just keeps his spine in line. And basically, he could probably hold up a steady scrum just as that angle. But on the other side, it's not going to happen. If the tight head takes strain on his side, everything is going to go, you know. So it's kind of like pulling that pin kind of thing. So look, everything's driven through him. It's a real specialized position, takes time, and hence the fact that, you know, Tyke Furlong is such a youngish tight head, so the potential is just massive where he's going to go. And just that's where you kind of learn your trade, I suppose, being in those positions and being on this platform, being in live situations, and you know, he's just going to grow.
It must be nice for you, BJ, to be sitting down and watching the matches and seeing CJ Stander playing for Ireland.
Yeah, I suppose CJ is a good mate of mine. You know, I'm happy for him playing such good rugby. I suppose he's, you know, I see it from a different perspective, not from as much as a supporter's perspective. You know, we have different chats. You know, he's been in Ireland now a long time, and he's really that stalwart at eight. You know, as we've seen how many minutes he's actually played in the World Cup so far. So I think he's quite irreplaceable there for me, massive part of that side. And yeah, he's been part of that now for the last, I suppose, I think last 12 months or just starting on that, and being part of the great win over the All Blacks and building up to that and building to a World Cup. Massive drive, massive motivation, such a great team guy. And, you know, he wears his heart on the sleeve, you know, whatever he does. And he makes that break, I suppose, from that tension and kind of nerves that build up to the big games. He's that kind of, even though he's still quite young, I suppose, he comes out and he shows that experience side of himself.
And just, BJ, like in the run-up to the Rugby World Cup, there was a lot of focus on the South African team after they posted that picture of themselves with no shirts on, and it wasn't in a positive light. There was questions over potentially not that team, but that there might be some sort of a doping culture in South Africa. What were your thoughts about the negativity that surrounded the run-up to the World Cup?
Well, I thought that picture was basically just showing how good Arlette Walters was.
Alad Waters is the fitness strength and conditioning program, but I must be honest, I felt like dropping him a message saying I followed your program for 3 years and I never got into that shape. So
yeah, look, I think it was, yeah, I suppose, you know, the guys are gymming in Japan and, you know, kind of having a group picture of the session, whatever they might be doing. Some of the guys are sumo wrestling, but look, it's a tough one, you know. It's very unfortunate what happened there. They're dealing it with a separate manner. WADA, World Association of Drugs, they're dealing with it in the manner it should be. You know, it does obviously send a certain negative vibe through, of course. But, you know, I think they would have been one part protected, the side, going into the World Cup from that. The guys would have, you know, had to make that break there and really just concentrate on what they've been building on. Again, this World Cup is a 3.5-year cycle building up to this tournament, you know, for some teams that, you know, so they build up to this and definitely don't want to let that go at the end from a negative perspective. But we've even seen in the media back in South Africa now, and keeping my ear to the ground there, some people's opinions about racial tension, certain things that have been within the group again, that is out there with Eben Estebeth. And again, one part just trying to, you know, instigate, but on the other side, things need to be taken down the right protocols, you know.
And just like yourself growing up in South Africa, like, I know there was focus on it, and that especially in schoolboys, 10% of schoolboy rugby players in South Africa between 15 and 18 admitted to taking some form of illegal substance. When you were growing up, did you ever see anything that made you feel uncomfortable?
No. Look, for me, it was basically, you know, I was also, you know, for me, it was basically mostly having fun, really playing, I suppose, in my school days, you know. School rugby was all about building that camaraderie, as they say, with your fellow pupils, fellow teammates, and, you know, building through that and going to the gym to get big and doing the work in the gym, going through and kind of, I suppose, drinking as much milk as you can in those days, getting your protein from that. Because, again, we didn't have the supplements, you know. I think coming up around 96, 97, when I was coming to the end of my school career, it was basically creatine was just introduced, and we were like, oh, what is this new thing on the market? So look, I don't know so much about kind of what's been said and obviously what's out there, and obviously statistics are out there, and that evidently probably shows, and I suppose it's always going to, in one part, be exposed. I suppose it needs to be dealt with, of course, you know, stringently. But I think, as again, the protocols are out there to deal with that. But I think as we see in other sports as well, and we've seen the massive people being exposed in cycling and athletics and these things, you know, and especially a team like in Russia, more so to light. And I think these have also been happening because, again, drugs testing has become so more advanced, and they keep testing and samples, you know, as when you get tested, you sign a form for basically if they can keep your test, I suppose, to test down the line. So these things are happening, and I suppose that's why more things are coming to the fore, you know.
We saw it as well with Munster, though, BJ, because we saw Grobler coming over and ultimately not staying because he just wasn't accepted because of his past. Did you think that he was treated fairly?
Yeah, I think what happened with Gebrant was obviously later on. I think he'd been there for a year. Am I right? And then this came up. Yeah, I suppose people probably knew for sure when he was contracted that this occurred. I think this happened closer to the time where you think he was injured or something, and I'm not too sure if it was something put in the media and the guys jumped on this. And then at the end of the day, I think his contract wasn't renewed. It was coming up to renewal, and I think that was all the hype about that. But, you know, Gerbrandt obviously, you know, tested positive and he was banned for 2 years. And obviously his movement overseas was to play for Munster. And that happened obviously after a year or year and a half, whatever, he got injured. And that's where it happened. But I suppose in one part, the protocols were there and fair decision. Obviously the decision was made by the RFU not to contract him. Of course, that's their decision. But I think the one part would be a little bit of the other side would be the guy. That the people, I suppose, Limerick's a small place, Munster's a small place, and Ireland as well, you know, you know, were supporting him on the field and off the field. And I think one part he probably left with his head down a little bit, you know, as from a human perspective. You know, he's gone over to England. I think he's playing in there. I'm not too sure following up to that. And again, I wasn't really a fan of the story. I was actually in France at that stage, but I did hear bits and pieces of it. But I would say that one part probably wasn't dealt with the way it should have been.
Donica, do you think that he was, first of all, treated fairly within Munster, and secondly, that there should be a way back for people who have failed drugs tests within rugby, within Irish rugby, really?
It's tough. It really is a hard one. I know for myself personally, I don't think he should have been signed. I thought that was a bad call, but I did feel that when he was in, and like BJ said, he was halfway through his season. The lads had become friendly with him. They'd become tight with him. They believed he served his 2 years. And they were willing to not only play with him, but put their bodies on the line with the guy. And they knew, and they've spoken to him about how remorseful he was. But I think for me, it became nearly another issue of a young man that was away from his family, away from his support network. And I think that's why Munster pulled around him. And I'm actually quite proud that Munster pulled around him in that moment. He had played for Racing at that point. I think anyone that cheats, and particularly when it comes to signing for Irish provinces, I don't think that should happen. I think that was the greater error. But I was disappointed that midway through it, as opposed to, like, if there was this furore about it earlier on, I don't think he would have signed. But he built bonds with those players, and then it was very difficult afterwards.
Yeah, I think for sure, to reiterate what Don is there, I think it should have been dealt with when the option came up to sign him, you know. And then I suppose it didn't, and this took place later, and then it became a little bit grey, you know, and the media caught on to that, the pressure from the media.
I know that you're living in Limerick now and your family there, so, like, what jerseys will they be wearing on Saturday for the day?
Yeah, cheapest, to be honest. I think the one, my boy has actually got a Springbok jersey, but the rest have got Irish. So look, there'll be a combination for sure. You know, they definitely got the country accent. So it's difficult to get past that.
I'm surprised it's not a Limerick hurling jersey.
Yeah, no, they've also got that. Don't worry about that. But yeah, so I think it would be an interesting one now if we had this Ireland-South Africa in the quarterfinal. But yeah, I think we'll be obviously wearing both. and just really and look. I mean, in perspective, it's great to see it'll be great to see Ireland push past New Zealand, and I still have belief that can happen for sure. I think everyone has that, and that's all you can really ask for, you know. And they would surely have that. So in South Africa, I think is obviously that little easier for me. But yeah, it'll be great to see them both push through.
Another guy I know you're close with, he used to drive you crazy, but is Dave Kilcoyne. And I know he leans heavily on you for advice. Do you keep in touch? Will he chat to you about what he should do this weekend against the All Blacks?
Yeah, I think Dave, me and Dave got on so well. You know, we obviously were right against there, scrummaging against each other for, you know, at Munster, which is unique and which is always interesting, you know, being up there. And David, from a youngster, always showed this aggressive side of himself, but also a very calm head, you know, and also showing that humorous side of him. And I'm just so happy for him, really, where he's come. He's really so determined and motivated, and he's basically, you know, kind of really put himself in this position. I think if you look at Dave 2 years ago, where he came now, he's just completely, you know, ignited. You know, and as I said, I think he could start for Ireland, really, and there'd be no difference, really. And he would probably add that little bit of X factor that he brings on the carrying side of things. And look, I do chat to him and stuff like that, but I think Dave is well aware what he needs to do and going forward with. But we would have a odd coffee now and then, and speak about and reminisce about the front row stories, I suppose.
I always got a kick out of that all he ever wanted was for you to wash him. And normal rugby players would be happy with fairy liquid in the shower. BJ had 3 different bottles and he gave himself an incredible wash in the shower. As opposed to Dave Kilcoyne, who was normally just running, throwing a t-shirt on and running up for food. But he used to always say that, BJ, I'd love BJ Botha to give me a scrub.
Well, hold on. Well groomed, as we call it, I suppose. But yeah.
And just BJ, before we let you go, like obviously here we're massively interested in Ireland versus New Zealand. Can you give us a prediction?
Yeah, I suppose the story before the prediction. My thinking is this: is that I think if we were going into this game, you know, having built some momentum through our results, but also through our play and management. From playing and managing the players through the pool stages, we put ourselves under some pressure now losing to Japan, getting over Scotland, obviously. But it's been a hard road, I felt, and I think we might pay for that in the last 20 minutes of the game. You know, we see past results going on. Something I mentioned to someone the other day, back in 2007 when France beat New Zealand, they made I think Terry Desertois made something like in the 30s tackles, you know. And I feel that's the effort it's going to take. But my question with that, can we do that with what we've played? You know, we've spoken about CJ earlier. He's played in every single game, the minutes the guys have played. But look, it's the strongest team they could ever select, really, at this time and place. And I think anything can happen. So let's hope, and I'll be shouting from this side for sure. But there's no doubt that it's going to be a massive challenge.
You know what I love in that? The amount of times you said we. BJ, thanks so much.
Lovely.
Thanks, BJ.
Thanks, guys. All the best there. Cheers, guys.
Welcome back to Game On with Marie and Dunica. Now, earlier we caught up with Rochdale player Paul McShane, and we began by asking him how he's getting on at his new club.
I've been here a week now, and I've really enjoyed it. I played my first game on Saturday straight in, and it was good to get that monkey off my back because I hadn't played in a long time. And I got the 90 minutes in, and I was glad we got a win as well. So yeah, it's started well.
We're still in football post-mortem mode here at the moment, and looking back on Tuesday night, were you watching Ireland? And if so, what did you think of them?
I did watch it. I just got to watch the first half, actually. I didn't see this. I was sort of in and out of the second half. Yeah, it was sort of a chance for us there, you know, to get a result and get qualified. But Switzerland are a decent side, and yeah, it is what it is. And you know, we just keep going and try hopefully get the result that was get us qualified in the future.
Do you think that we can get a result against Denmark now next time out?
Well, I'm an optimist, so yeah. Even though the record against Denmark hasn't been great recently, you know, you've got to be positive and stuff, and you know, a lot of things to obviously work on, and just, you know, I'll always believe that Ireland can pull out a result. So I'm positive about getting a result against Denmark.
Paul, you mentioned there that you're a positive mindset going into stuff. Mick McCarthy said he's surprised by the negativity around the team. What would be your take on that?
Well, there's been a negativity around the team for quite a long time, to be honest. You know, sometimes it's not the prettiest of football, but I think the team has been looking at a results-based sort of performance, and as long as we're getting them results, I don't think things will change much. I know that the fans and stuff would like some good football played, but it's a results-driven business, and Mick is just trying to get the team into a major tournament. So that's the, you know, different styles, different managers. So just got to keep going. I know the negativity around the team is, it's always been there, and lads will just get on with it, because I know the lads are a good, honest bunch of lads, and they'll give everything when they pull the green jersey on. So yeah, you know, just got to stay positive and hope that we can get over the line and get into another major tournament.
You've always said that you'd be available for your country whenever they needed you, and that you'd let Ireland retire you. Do you think that, like, playing for Ireland could still be an option for you again, Paul?
I do believe that, yeah. I still believe it, yeah. I know I've been in this game a long time now. I know football can change very quickly. You know, it did seem a million miles away there the last couple of years, but, you know, I feel I'm back to full fitness at the minute, so touch wood, I can stay as fit as I can and get as many games under my belt as possible, and just see where it goes. But as I said, I'll always be available for my country, and you know, who knows what will happen in the future.
Do you feel you got a fair crack at the whip, Paul, playing in the green jersey for Ireland?
I got a call up when I was 20 years of age, and I was put straight in against Czech Republic, and you know, it started great and stuff, you know, it was brilliant. So I got a good crack at it there. As years went on, obviously I sort of, my opportunities were diminished a little bit, and I'm not gonna play the hard luck story. You know, I would have liked to have played more in the last few years, obviously when I was playing in the Premier League and stuff, and I didn't get a start, or didn't get in squads, so I would have liked to have got in more squads and more starts at the time. But here, that's football, and that's life, and that's the way it's gone.
And just on that, like, why do you think you didn't get in, Paul?
I don't know. You've got to ask the managers that.
And did you ask them? Like, did you go to them?
Huh?
Do you in that situation? Do you go to the managers and say, like, why haven't I been picked?
Yeah, I think you've got to have that as a player. Yeah, I think you've got to show hunger to play for your country. And you know, I'd make the phone call if I wasn't in. I'd ring the managers and stuff and see what the story was. And I think more players should be like that. I think you've got to ask the questions, and you know, the managers have to have the answers.
Speaking of new managers, Brian Barry Murphy in Rochdale. How are things going in Rochdale?
Yeah, good. I've been, as I said, I've been here a week. It seems good. It's a good set of lads. A lot of honesty from the boys, which I've sort of missed in the last couple of years. You know, Reading was tough in the end, and you know, it was a tough place to be at times. So I'm just glad that it's a fresh start for me, and you know, everyone here seems to want to improve and want to give everything that they've got, and that goes from the coaches all the way through the playing staff. I got the feel when I first come in the place that they, and for, when I first spoke to Brian, that everybody wanted to improve here and go to the next level. So I wanted to be a part of something. And there's a few Irish lads here. That's always good to have a few Irish lads, you know, for the crack and stuff. So it's a good place to be at the minute. So hopefully we can keep getting results and climb up the table.
Dunica was actually in school with Brian, and he told me the story yesterday that when they were in school sports day, that he used to win everything, like the long kick, the 800 metres, the hurdles, everything that you could possibly win in sports day, he did. What kind of a manager is he?
He's very good. He has a great relationship with the players. It's really good atmosphere. I felt that on the first day, and you just get involved, and everyone has a say. It's not like a dictatorship. You know, we're trying to solve problems here. If there's a problem on the pitch, he wants people to be vocal, and he wants to hear people's opinions. And you know, I think it's a good way to be. So he's open to all ideas, and the way that Brian's got the team playing is really good. It's an enjoyable way to play, and it's quite nice on the eye. So I'm just hoping now that we can keep getting good results, and as I said, get up that table.
Obviously, who was player coach for a while, does he still tug out?
I've seen him going for a few runs around the pitch every now and again, but he sort of joins in a little bit, as in just serving balls in. But I haven't seen him join in a full session yet. But it's early doors, and I've only done, I think, 4 or 5 sessions, so he could be getting involved more in the future. I don't know.
Just for a young coach there, obviously his football knowledge is through the roof. Is he getting supported by the club and all the other types of selection decisions he needs help with?
Yeah, I think he gets the full support from the club. And also, I spoke to the CEO, David Bottomley, and him. He's fully behind the manager. You know, the coaches around him are a good support, and he's got a good team above him and around him. So he's got a good foundation to build off, and he can only get better and better.
Obviously, you're still young, but you know, you have a whole life ahead of you. Do you have plans for what you'll do afterwards?
Hollywood for me, I think.
Donegal, you can take Donegal with you.
Yeah, straight into the acting. Yeah. And I've done my coaching badges and stuff. I've got my A and B coaching badges. So I would be looking to get a little bit more into the coaching, hopefully. And but we'll see. You know, as things can change quickly, and you don't know where you'd be. So I just hope to play for a good few more years. I've got a little eye on coaching, and I'll give that a bash and see where it takes me.
FM. Welcome back to Game On with Marie and Donegal. That was Paul McShane there chatting to us. Interesting, Donegal, to hear him say he would still like to play for Ireland, and you have to say fair play to him. Yeah. Like, I mean, he's back. He hopes anyway, playing regular football. He's had his first 90 minutes with Rochdale again. And when you're a player who dreamed of playing for Ireland when you were growing up, I'm sure that trying to get the most out of your career at the top level, international level, is key.
Yeah, it's good to hear, like, everything he's done, the sacrifices he's made. He was, you know, he didn't have a club, but still went away and got a personal trainer, made sure that he was ready to go. I'm interested in with Brian Barry Murphy, obviously from pedigree from Cork, Jimmy Barry Murphy's son, just all-round good guy, and just you want him to do well. But you want to hear people saying that. You don't want guys just saying, yeah, I'm just happy to fade out. You know, you want him having aspirations and trying to get back in the team.
You mentioned Brian Barry Murphy there. I know you were in school together. Was he as prolific as an athlete as his father?
We spoke about it there. He could do it all. Brian Barry Murphy was actually quite annoying. We were saying about the sports day. He'd win the egg and spoon, long kick, long puck, the whole lot. He could do everything. And I think it may be a bit of a loss around Cork hurling, definitely. But you're kind of glad. For me, I'm kind of glad that he's gone away and made his own name, because they're big shoes to fill around Cork. You know, JBM's son,
Son of God.
Son. It's too big to nearly handle, isn't it? But it's great to see that. And it's an important thing for me, Marie, that I think he needs support. You just listen to Paul there, and 100% his soccer knowledge is going to be through the roof. But I just think I'd love if they surrounded him with good people that would help him. With stuff like selection can be quite tough, and actually how to deal with a player. You know, as a player it's easy, but then when you're actually making a call on someone's livelihood, that actually changes everything.
Yeah, and it's such a results-based business, professional sport, and you know, even if you have a lull period or things don't go to plan, like, you become collateral damage very, very quickly.
Straight back into the Cork setup.
Yeah, I'm sure there'll be a role for him somewhere. Absolutely. Now it is time for our American sports slot, and we are joined once again by Jeff Shepherd. Jeff, we chatted last week about the Houston Rockets and how they have gotten themselves into an international political controversy with China and everything that's going on in Hong Kong since then. LeBron James gave a bit of a disastrous interview. We're going to hear from him in a little bit, but just remind us of the story so far.
Yeah, exactly, Marie. So Houston Rockets general manager Daryl Morey tweeted out a week or so ago, basically, fight for freedom, stand with Hong Kong. And they are, you know, protesting in the streets of Hong Kong, you know, for their freedom and independence, you know, from China. And this, you know, it just kind of took off and it became...
Shep, we're losing you there, so we're actually just going to play the LeBron clip and see if we can get you back on the line.
if he wasn't educated on the situation at hand, and he spoke, and so many people could have been harmed, not only financially but physically, emotionally, spiritually. So just be careful what we tweet and we say and what we do, even though, yes, we do have freedom of speech, but there can be a lot of negative that comes with that, too.
Well, he later clarified his statement on Twitter, which sparked further outrage on social media. That's what happens there. Activists in Hong Kong and even U.S. politicians jumping in or jumping on LeBron.
So that was a little bit from LeBron James there. Shep, he's hitting the headlines for all the wrong reasons, and it's not like our LeBron over there to be doing that.
No, not at all. I mean, he is, you know, usually pretty locked in on things that are going on, you know, from a social perspective. I think the thing that he was trying to get across was, look, we were going to be in the country, and it maybe, the timing of it was done probably for a very good reason, because the NBA players were going to be in China. But to LeBron's point, I think what he was probably trying to say was, look, you know, it could have gotten really dangerous for us while we were over here because of this tweet that was sent out. And, it needed to probably be thought out better. I think that's probably what he was trying to say. It obviously did not come across that way. And one of the reasons we know that is because after he gave those remarks, he wound up sending two tweets to try to explain what he was trying to say in the interview. And again, we talked about this last week. I mean, this is an unbelievably sticky situation that is not just involving the NBA. I mean, there's so much going on here, and there are so many other American companies that are dealing with the exact same issue. It's just the tweet has just thrust this into, you know, the forefront of American sports and politics and all of this right now. I mean, you know, basketball is really, really very popular. It's really popular on social media. It's, you know, the easiest game that's being exported globally. And so there's just so much going on here. But it's just, boy, those comments, they just sound so ridiculous. And look, the stories are starting to come out now about, you know, how angry the players are about this all happening, because they're the ones with the shoe contracts and they're the ones who had to cancel appearances while they were over there and lose money. And, you know, even though they're all very well paid and they're all multimillionaires, or most of them are, you know, they all still feel like, look, man, you're taking money out of my pocket because I had to cancel this, or this contract might not work out, or something like that. So it is really just an unbelievable situation. And I don't think we're done with it anytime soon.
Moving away from it onto football, obviously, I'm a late adapter to NFL, but trying to get up to speed and just trying to find a team. I think, just for me, the Green Bay Packers feels like a right fit. Would you encourage it or steer me away from them?
Well, look, first off, I think it's great. We have converted another fan, you know, to American football. Next thing you know, you'll be calling football soccer, and then it'll just all be downhill from there. But look, the Packers are always, I mean, I think it's a great, you know, great franchise. It's one of America's great sporting franchises across all sports over here. You know, it's a small town, it's the smallest market television wise in the NFL. You know, the fan ownership, I mean, Lambeau Field, the frozen tundra. I would recommend you go back and, you know, on YouTube, look up the Ice Bowl and Super Bowl I and Super Bowl II. And, I mean, you can just really kind of look back and see, you know, how great of a franchise they are. And, of course, they had Brett Favre, and now they have Aaron Rodgers, and all of those things are great. The only thing that I would tell you is, I mean, look, they're not the New Orleans Saints, and that's who you really need to be pulling for. But I can understand if you go with the Packers. I don't think you won't upset anybody. And, obviously, they've got green in their, you know, one of their color patterns as well. So it's a perfect fit.
Do you know what I like about them? I like the tradition, the history, what they're about. You're saying there that they're actually that they're owned by the fans. I think that's really important. Yeah. I love that about it. I love the fact that they'll always be there. They just won't pick up and leave. And they represent the people around them, and they're full of tradition and history. That's why I like them.
It is. One of the really unique things about it is, it's not
you go into the other big cities around America, and you know there's these massive stadiums, and they're usually in the downtown area. Lambeau Field is literally like in the middle of a neighborhood in the middle of Green Bay, Wisconsin. I mean, it's like, oh no, you just go around the corner by Tony's house, and it's just across the street. I mean, it's just the weirdest, coolest situation that they have going on. So now the Packers, I think unless you're like from Chicago or Minneapolis or Detroit, you kind of almost like the Packers as probably like your second favorite team just about everywhere you go in America.
Shep, I'm a Chicago Bears fan. Would you be happy with that?
Well, the Saints are in Chicago this weekend, so we shall see.
Oh, here we go.
We'll have something to talk about so next week with that.
I like American football, though. It's great to have a sport that is designed around snacking. You know what I mean? Like, that is, every 2 minutes, I mean, there's a time to leg it out and get something out of the fridge.
That's right. Chicken wings and nachos. I mean, it is the perfect game.
Look, Shep, thanks a million for joining us, and we will be back to talk to you next week. We'll be discussing results of our various teams, I think.
Go Packers.
Awesome. That sounds great. Looking forward to it.
Thanks, Shep. Donica, so we've had a few texts in for the rugby because it is coming around the corner very quickly. And this one texter says that they're very disappointed with the negativity around our rugby team. The reality is sport has its ups and downs. We are a good team. Have faith. Should we have faith, Donica?
Yeah, I think we should have faith. I think we should get behind them as well. We really should. I know Mick McCarthy was saying there's a bit of negativity around it. But look, this is the biggest game under Joe Schmidt's tender. And I'll be honest, for him, you would want a performance. The guy has changed Irish rugby. He's set a new standard. I think there's an onus on those players to deliver, though. I really do think the big players need to step up, and I'd love if we all got behind them because it matters. It really does. And we'll need to play beyond ourselves to do the All Blacks, but we're well capable.
Absolutely, and that's all we have time for. Thanks to everybody for listening. From me and Donica, goodbye. Tara Stewart is up next.